The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Hello and welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices. This is Rachel Silva. I'm sitting with Liz Webb. We're sitting here with John Byrne, director at the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy. He is also a distinguished professor of energy and climate policy at the University of Delaware. So we're here just, you know, asking him a few questions about his job here at UD.
John, so what is the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy, and what type of work do you do there?
Okay. So the center was created back in the 1980s, so we've been around a while, and it's a center that mostly has graduate students engaged in research at various scales from the local to the global, but we also have undergraduate students increasingly involved as well. Okay, and so examples of what we do, we presented our briefing paper in Paris 2 years ago. There was a big climate change meeting there, and we presented what we thought was the appropriate strategy. And then on the local level, we work on, for example, brownfields in the city of Wilmington. About 70% of the residential areas have contaminated lands that are not good for children and for elders to be exposed to, and we work on both identifying that and strategies to abate that sort of thing.
So you have worked with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Yes.
So tell us, can you tell us about your work with that?
So yeah, we'll shorten it to IPCC since it's way too many syllables otherwise. So the IPCC was created by a series of UN bodies to inform the world community on what we know about both the mechanics, the science of climate change, and what we know about its social footprint and policy options. And so I got started in that back in the early 1990s. I would say it's nearly all volunteer. Everyone that works basically volunteers their own time and effort to participate in the assessments. The assessments come out usually in three volumes, each weighing in at like, 900 to 1,000 pages. So it's really, all of this has to be done by consensus. The chapters are often written by 6 or 8 or 10 folks that are focused on that field, and I had the privilege of working on several chapters in the IPCC over many years. And I think the importance of the body is that it provides an independent means for the public globally, as well as locally, the public to look at what's known and what are our concerns and why are folks worried about this phenomenon.
I heard that the IPCC actually won a Nobel Peace Prize.
They did, along with the former Vice President Al Gore, yes.
Okay.
So I have to say, when I first got involved back in the early 90s, nobody knew IPCC what? I mean, there was no, it was somewhat esoteric, and so I have to say it's one of the more exciting parts of my life to have been had a chance to work with so many thoughtful and devoted people trying to figure out how to help the world address this really serious. I don't think there's any doubt it is the grand challenge of our time. It affects everything from health and wealth to our biodiversity to climate justice to who is paying the greatest burden when and that kind of thing. So I think that's clearly a grand challenge of our time. And I hope that you guys will help us, because I'm going to leave the planet, and we need, much sooner than you are, and we need sustained effort. This is a problem that's going to take most of the 21st century to solve.
Right.
So we need you.
So I was wondering, you said that you started working in the early 90s. So over the course of your career, how do you feel like there's been a greater global awareness of climate change and the necessity to do something about it?
Yeah. I think the social awareness has really expanded, and I have the privilege of going to different parts of the world, and once upon a time in the early 90s, I would do a talk on climate change, and people were kind of puzzled over what does this mean, and outside of a narrow group of scientists, there was very little understanding or awareness of the issue. But now I think everywhere I go, it is a problem well discussed. I think the issue that has come up is, I think even, and maybe I'm misreading, but I think the American public generally also understands that this is a very serious issue. And I do believe that the younger generation of the American society gets it much more clearly than other parts of the society. That said, there's been a problem in communication with governments, not only in the U.S., but unfortunately, significantly in the U.S. Governments feel threatened by the challenge and the kind of things that they think are needed in order to solve the problem. And because of that fear, governments often try to deny its existence. And that's unfortunate. That's not good for any of us. It's not good for next generations.
And how do you try and combat this fear that the government has, and how to stop it from spreading and gaining ground in public opinion?
Yeah. So I think there are a couple of important strategies there. Actually, the things we need to do could create in the sense of what's sometimes called the triple bottom line of getting an economic benefit, getting a social benefit, and getting an environmental benefit. Certainly over the next 20 to 30 years, what we need to do, you talked with the folks over at IEC, we need to move from non-renewable energy sources to renewable energy sources. Mm-hmm. And that's actually very good for you. The price of electricity coming from solar and wind sources, for example, is now competitive with the non-renewable options. So it's a really good one. So that's good. That gives you the environmental, okay? It creates more jobs by a factor of 4 to 1. So if you're trying to move into an opportunity in the future where the economy is better, and it allows you, if you use less of the conventional energy and more of the other, and I think the most important resource in that regard is to just use less conservation and energy efficiency. If we do that, we actually have the ability socially to make decisions about other problems we think need to be solved, okay? You guys are carrying a lot of debt in student loans and that kind of thing. This needs to be adjusted, and if we did this, we would have a dividend that would allow us to pursue those social objectives as well. So that's the triple bottom line, the social, the economic, and the environmental. And I think when it's presented properly that way, certainly the wider public, civil society, understands the value, and governments sometimes... the depiction of government, especially abroad, that the U.S. government, it's what is happening in Washington. And what's happening in Washington has not been a pleasant story on climate change for...
Right.
But remember, you also live in a society where 34 states require as a condition of sale of electricity into them that a percentage must come from renewable energy. Those 34 states passed those laws. Okay, there are 23 states that now require that the actual amount of electricity sold in the jurisdiction go down by using conservation and energy efficiency techniques. And if you look at the decisions that many in your generation have begun to make about transportation and using other methods than simply the personal car for this kind of thing, you guys have kind of ushered in a variety of things where we treat transportation as a service, and we use an app to beckon the service, and we don't spend enormous amounts of money storing a very expensive piece of technology in a garage that's semi-heated so that we can use it 1 hour a day or something. I mean, this is kind of crazy, right? So I think all of those kinds of things are all happening at the state and local level. So I would encourage, when we think about government, that we understand that government has three levels: federal, state, and local. And the state and local has actually been, in the U.S., has actually been very creative.
And speaking about the government and the current administration, how do you think things will change for your work in public policy?
I think the problem that I think is the biggest problem because of this administration, is that it's basically taking an anti-science, anti-research position. It's actually it's proposing not to fund data collection. Now, how can we compete in the modern world and we won't collect data? This is not, I think, very sensible. But what I think that does, unfortunately, is it puts the U.S. behind in this kind of effort to solve this problem. And I give you one very practical example of what happens. And I think that this is going to happen again, unfortunately. So back when earlier President George W. Bush Jr., during the campaign, he had said that he would sign an important treaty that would allow the U.S. to participate in making decisions about climate-related investments and so on. And then after the election was done, he decided that he wasn't going to support that. And I met with a good friend in China who was the head of the Energy Research Institute there, and he asked me, is it really true that your president is going to not sign? And I said, yeah, I think that's correct. And he said, but the country is really going to? And I said, yes. And he looked at me and he said, thank you. I had no idea. Why are you saying thank you to me? It's something you can read in the newspaper. I'm just telling you that. What he meant was that China intended to compete for renewable energy manufacturing. And if the U.S. was not going to get engaged, that would make it much easier for China to. What's the story? At the time that the president made that decision, China had about less than 10% of the entire manufacturing of solar cells in the world. They're now 80%. We lost a lot of opportunity by that decision, okay? That also, though, tells what I think is the important story as well, the second part of it. Because the U.S. fails to act, and because our society then loses some ability to contribute to these solutions in some ways, it doesn't mean that the solutions aren't going to happen. We use the fastest growing source of you talked with my friends at IEC, what's the fastest growing source of new electricity in the world?
Solar energy.
That's right. What's the fastest growing source in the United States? Solar energy. How many jobs are created by solar compared to the coal industry? The coal industry is in rapid decline, and the number of jobs created by solar is roughly on the order of 5 to 6 times, 7 times as many jobs. So even if our government decides to sit on the sideline and not compete, and that's what we're doing, unfortunately, and remember, you're a member of this society, and unfortunately that decision is putting you in that awkward situation where your society is not competing. Even when we do that, the world still moves ahead. So these kinds of solutions, I think, are going to come forward.
And just to backtrack a little bit, so as you know, we sat down with Bill Schafferman and Steve Hegedus at the Institute of Energy Conversion last week. Mm-hmm. So I know that a lot of what they do has to do with solar energy and its applicability in everyday life. Mm-hmm. Do you work close with them, or is your work mostly independent, or is there a lot of communication between the two groups of policy?
Excellent question. It's my view, and so when we're the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy, but only if we can understand where science and engineering is can we really think about really good policy, right? So there has been an intimate relationship for a long time. Stephen Hegedus teaches we require all of our graduate students to take a course in engineering in the field of sustainable energy and environment, and his course is the most popular course. And so we've stayed on that sort of academic level, but also we are engaged in a very large effort to look at our communities and the rooftops of the communities as the new power plant. You're collecting solar energy on this roof in the ice lab here as we talk, okay? You're collecting solar energy, but you're not doing anything with it, okay? If we use solar cell technology like what's being invented at the IEC, we can begin to replace our power plant, and we don't have to find some fancy somewhere else. We can use our rooftops. And in fact, our estimates are that even in vertical cities, cities in which people live in apartments that are in buildings that are 20, 30 floors, like New York City, that roughly 65% of the electricity of the city could be provided by the energy that's already collecting on the roofs in the city, okay? During the daytime, that's, you know, obviously at night you're going to have to, but even then, okay, if you use a little storage, you can pick up that same kind of opportunity. So they're inventing better technology. We're trying to roll that better technology into models of cities that we're making that will have the new energy plant coming from the rooftops, and how to finance it, and how on policy, how to give the right policy incentives so that the investors will come into the process. So we're very closely coordinating in that regard. We depend upon them to think about the technology. They depend upon us to think about the policy, economics, and finance of how to use the technology.
So we also wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on the recent Paris Agreement? And do you think it can reach its goal of reducing global warming?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. And yeah. And some believe that the Paris Accord doesn't go far enough, and I'm one who thinks that it's not as ambitious as we actually need. But that said, I am a supporter of the effort to work inside the framework of the Paris Accords. And the big difference that I think happened between Paris and all the previous meetings is that in Paris, finally, instead of trying to build sort of a top-down, highly expert-based regime that said we're going to price carbon this way or that way, and then everybody's going to set up markets and all that, all of which I think is a viable option, but many societies don't see that as the best way to reduce the amount of carbon they use. They have many other better ideas that make sense for their people. And what Paris did was to create what's called a polycentric strategy. Instead of a single center strategy, many strategies, which I think is very important for policy in the future. And we learn from each other, we try each other's ideas, we each experiment, okay, and in this process try to. And I think already you can see the Paris Accord as being more successful in reducing carbon than what its predecessor policy approaches are. So, in my opinion, you guys are living in a period of policy experiment that is actually positive for us, okay, and hopefully can help us to tackle the problem.
You mentioned the climate policies prior to the Paris Agreement. So what are your thoughts on the effectiveness of those other international climate policies?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they had their benefits. Trying to set up a market had its benefit, but it also had its problem, okay? The trying to police that market and make sure that the things that people were saying they were going to do is what they actually did was costly and sometimes not very effective. It's not easy to do something like that, and I think we're better off looking when it's appropriate to some of the earlier policy frameworks that we had and trying to build them in, but having them, instead of having a single or primary strategy, which I think was the flaw of the earlier policy structures, we can add it as one thing, but we ought to try these other many, many things, okay? Like trying to change the the fastest growing source of new greenhouse gas emissions is the transportation sector, largely because of our personal vehicles. This is worldwide as well as in the U.S. If we want to change that, we have to change our relationship with the vehicle. We can't just make the vehicle better. We have to change, okay? And so these approaches where we take transportation and make it a service, where we utilize more public transit, when we try out bicycling, when we try to live without having to own a car, okay? Those things can have very important positive impacts for the long run. And I think that kind of experimentation that's going on at the local level, I give you one quick example of one that I think is really good from an alum of our center. Johanna Gregory Parton was graduated from our master's program, and she became the energy and climate director of the city of San Francisco, and she championed the idea of carless weekends, that the center city would have no car traffic, instead buses would take you in. Originally, people were especially the retail community, the business community, was very concerned about what it was going to mean. They found that people actually found it so easy now to get in and out of the city that way, that the number of people that were in the city on the weekends, and they organized festivals and a whole series of other things, that it's now one of the most popular programs that the city offers, and it's being copied around the world. And it dramatically reduces carbon on those weekends.
Related to that, how do you think, what steps can the university community take to fight global warming and save our environment?
Yes, that's a very important one. So our center prepared the climate action plan for our university and listed out a whole series of steps that we need to take. One of those was to increase, since we are, hopefully you learned at the IEC, that we are one of the world's best in the engineering of solar cells. One practical recommendation of the Climate Action Plan was we should use more of it on campus, and you know, down at the field house that the and our center actually designed the request for proposals in order to get that technology in. But the university has been very slow on improving energy efficiency and conservation. And I know you're in rooms that you sit in classrooms when you know it's too hot during some winter days and too cold others, and when you're in there in the spring and the air conditioning is roaring along and all of that, and you know, people are putting on sweaters to sit through a class, right? Okay, that kind of thing is happening. Our university has not taken the kind of comprehensive approach, particularly in our buildings, to do that. And I just want to point out, you know that that costs money, right? When you use energy inefficiently, and who's paying for it?
That's correct.
You pay the tuition. So I think it's a reasonable question. Do you want to pay your tuition in order to have energy inefficiency, or would you like to see something that was much more energy efficient? And I think the university owes it to the community to do a better job on that score.
Okay. And how do you think us as students are able to impact the university or the community here on campus, and kind of motivate other students to take that initiative? How do you think that's possible?
Yeah, very, very good. So you have had a number of worthy organizations that you have organized. Students have organized. Students for the Environment is an example, okay? These are very good student-based organizations that champion strategies and promote. So I think that's something. And getting involved, treating the university as a policy unit, like policies are being made, we should have students engaged in questioning whether those policies are satisfactory, okay? As I say, the second thing is to challenge on the intellectual side. This is a problem that's going to take the better part of the century to solve. And you folks have the ability to insist that we provide the variety of courses and other approaches that will allow research opportunities that will allow students to become engaged in that regard, okay? Mm-hmm. And the third thing I would just suggest is that you also consider certainly the faculty have a big role, faculty and staff have a big role in this, but so do students. Mm-hmm. I forget the exact number, but it's something in excess of 5,000 cars that visit the fine, fine city of Newark every day. Mm-hmm. And why are they coming in? It's commute in and out of the city, okay? And so I think the problem that we need to solve also to some extent is that we need to look at ourselves and figure out how to. And if I could add, just beyond the campus, I think there's a lot of much needed things in the wider world that students could contribute to. I'm not trying to burden you with my generation put a lot of the carbon up in the atmosphere. Your generation is going to have to deal with it. That's a climate justice issue, so you can remember who made you. Okay. But I think that getting you engaged in the wider issues would also be, certainly on our own campus, but I hope also that you'll think about being engaged as global citizens in this problem.
And one final question. So this is more so for students studying in the arts or sciences that they're not sure exactly how to apply. Mm. How did you really come across this career path of following public policy and doing such impressive work?
Oh, you're very kind, too kind. But So my in my own case, I enjoyed the challenge of what is now called, but in my time, this was a word that few people used, interdisciplinary, that you actually tried to understand from different perspectives and different research platforms what's going on, so that you didn't just sort of tunnel vision things. And that's really what interested me a great deal in that regard, okay, so that interdisciplinary. And I have to say, our artists and our colleagues in the humanities often find extraordinarily impressive ways to tell us the story of what is the problem, much better certainly than sometimes the sort of scientist or the social scientist or scientist are doing. So I think, again, it's an all-in. The Nobel Peace Prize, as you mentioned, has to do with what former Vice President Gore did, and he did it partly through lending his effort to a film that changed the dialogue in the U.S., changed the dialogue worldwide. I think our arts community is critical for us to be able to address this in the long run. So, and that includes our friends in English. And many of you know, I don't know if you've interviewed yet, I have no idea, McKay Jenkins, but we have a really, really good person on these kinds of issues that knows how to frame and let us understand in our own context, both personal context and family and social context, let us understand what this is really about. And we need everybody, and we certainly need our artists.
Thank you so much, John.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's great speaking with you.
It's a nice, time, a nice weather, and nice time to be talking about these issues, and hopefully you'll remember to help. Mm-hmm. We need
Definitely.
Your help.
Definitely.
Okay.
All right. This is Rachel Silva and Liz Webb here talking with John Byrne, Director at the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy and Distinguished Professor of Energy and Climate Policy here at the University of Delaware. Thank you, John, so much for letting us speak with you, and we look forward to speaking with you again sometime.
I hope so. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Liz.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.